but I want to talk about a little bit. We were looking at, when we were looking at the 13 principles, we were looking at the various principles that the Maimonides articulates regarding the role of prophecy and the unique prophetic experience of Moshe Rabbeinu, that the magnitude and the quality and the nature of his prophecy was something that was unparalleled with any other prophets, that Moshe could come to God whenever he wanted. Moshe was in a state of consciousness and alertness as opposed to the idea of escaping the body. And that leads to the Rambam's next principle regarding the immutability of the Torah, that the Torah will never change, that because there will never be a prophet that could supersede the prophetic experience of Moshe. So there's just a few points to make about that. This was a major point, actually, that Maimonides articulates over and over again in his commentary to the Mishnah, in the 13 Principles of Faith, in the Mishnah Torah, in his halachic works. And Maimonides envisions a very, very limited role for prophetic inspiration in the interpretation of halacha. Essentially, basically, he says that if a prophet comes and tells you that God told me that from now on Shabbat should be observed on Sunday, or from now on the laws of Kashrut need not be observed, even if the Navi does all of the miracles in the world, because we do recognize that miracles can be employed for nefarious purposes, Maimonides rules, based on rulings in the Talmud, that prophecy is not a basis for the transmission or the interpretation of halakha. And this is encapsulated in the Talmudic phrase, Ein hanavi rishai l'chadesh davar, that a prophet cannot innovate in matters of halakha. And it's ironically based on a verse in Deuteronomy that lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven, which Maimonides interprets as meaning Torah cannot be interpreted through prophecy or divine inspiration, because there is nothing that comes after the nebuah of Moshe Rabbeinu other than explaining and elaborating and applying that prophecy, but not changing it, not modifying it, not adding to it, not supplementing it. And Maimonides makes this point very, very strongly. And if you think about this, in fact, Maimonides basically says that the halachic reason, very interesting, what is the halachic reason why you cannot be a Jewish Christian? Right? There are Jews, you know, who allegedly believe in Jesus. So many people say, well, the second coming, etc. But the technical halachic reason why a Jew cannot be a Christian is because one of the tenets of Christianity, well, of course, there are a few reasons. I mean, one is the idea of multiplicity in God, etc. But the other reason is this ikar, that Christianity is predicated on the abrogation of the Torah in favor of a Brit Chadasha, in favor of a new covenant or a new testament. And that would be inconsistent with the fundamental doctrine of faith, that the Torah is non-changing and is everlasting. So the second coming issue is kind of a weak read. I mean, we have some very, very religious Jews now, Lubavitch Hasidim, that essentially are articulating the doctrine of the second coming regarding their belief in Mashiach. So obviously people can be religious Jews and talk about a second coming of somebody, Rebbe will come back from the dead, etc., to be Mashiach. So it's not the second coming that is the great theological impediment to a Jew accepting Christianity, but number one, it is of course diverse ideas of God, which is the big one, and the second one is the abrogation of the mitzvot in favor of a New Testament. And so that's the immutability of Torah. Now then Maimonides goes on and says, we do find a limited role for Nebuah. So why do we have prophetic books? What do the prophets do? I mean, essentially we're saying prophets have no say in the interpretation of Torah. So what is it that prophets do? We have books of prophecy. So Maimonides says, prophets do predict the future. Prophets communicate messages from God, not regarding changing halakha, but regarding the imperatives of observing halakha and the like. And then Maimonides points out that there is a limited role in the halachic process or divine inspiration, and that is a prophet has the power to temporarily suspend a mitzvah of the Torah, or what is called Horat Sha'ah. Horat Sha'ah means that there's a state of emergency, and it is necessary to do something in order to sanctify the name of God. And the classical example of Horat Sha'ah is what Eliyahu HaNavi did on Mount Carmel. If you remember, in the Book of Kings, it is recorded that Eliyahu HaNavi built an altar on Mount Carmel near Haifa, and the prophets of the Baal built an altar, and this was to be a contest, and Eliyahu HaNavi called on God to send fire down from heaven to consume the offerings, and the prophets of the Baal were also dancing around and mutilating themselves and pulling out their hair and self-flagellation, and the Baal was not responding that day, and Eliyahu HaNavi said to them, maybe your God is taking a nap, why don't you shout louder? And what happened eventually was, of course, as we know, Eish, fire, came down from heaven and consumed Eliyahu HaNavi's korban, and everybody was moved to a mass repentance. Hashem Hu Elokim, the same words we recite at the end of Yom Kippur, is taken from that episode. God is the true God. And there was mass repentance that actually lasted for one day only, because by the next day Eliyahu HaNavi was a fugitive once again, so it didn't have a permanent effect. But what's interesting is Eliyahu HaNavi summoning fire from heaven was actually a violation of halakha, because there was a Beit HaMikdash in Jerusalem at the time, and when you have a Beit HaMikdash, one is not allowed to bring offerings outside of the temple. So how could Eliyahu HaNavi transgress the halakha of bringing an offering outside of the temple? The answer is, this was called Horat Sha'ah. This was an emergency, one-time situation, which was designed to publicly sanctify the name of God. So Maimonides concedes that Nevuah has a very limited role in that sense, but generally speaking, it is not part of the halachic process. Now, if you analyze this sociologically, you see a very interesting phenomenon. That sociologically, the exclusion of charismatic prophecy from the halachic process is actually a great guarantee against its adulteration. Why is this? Because, like you have, for example, fundamentalist preachers and the like who say, God came to me last night, and God told me, you know, you're supposed to give me all of your money. Or like what happens in the Mormon church, basically. It's a very, very confusing idea, because, for example, in the Mormon church for many years, blacks were not admissible into the church, and one day the elder, and obviously that becomes socially untenable as time goes on, and there seems to be the convenient idea that God always appears to somebody at a time when it's socially untenable to have the old way, and said, God came to me last night and said that from now on we can admit everybody. In other words, the concept is, you know, God comes to you when you need to make a change. Now, imagine the scenario if prophecy would be admissible to determine halakha. You could have all sorts of charlatans, all sorts of false prophets, all sorts of people who would have no proof or substantiation for what they say other than saying God came to them. The way the system is constituted right now, you know, if I come and I say, you know, God told me that this is the halakha, it just doesn't count. I have to take the existing text, I have to argue with logic and with precedence and with structure to justify my conclusion. So in a way, the exclusion of prophecy from the halachic process means ultimately that halacha must be justified on the basis of logic and persuasiveness and precedence and fidelity to an existing structure, and therefore this prevents its adulteration by spurious claims that God simply changed the rules. Because how do you disprove that? In other words, now if somebody states a halakhic position, it can be disproved by showing that it's inconsistent with the existing structure. But if prophecy could change things wholesale, there would be literally no basis for disproof. How do you argue against prophecy? The answer is, you don't have to argue against prophecy, because prophecy becomes irrelevant in the determination of the halakhic process. So one can look at this in a sociological standpoint, that this is a vital protector against charlatans that would try to undermine the structure.
So what is the role of the classical? Is that because it's not a private relationship
with
God?
Yeah, the truth of the matter is that that's a very controversial problem. We find, for example, in the Talmud that certain halachic matters were resolved by what's called a bat kol. A bat kol is a heavenly voice. Bat kol literally means the daughter of a voice, a kind of a second level prophecy. For example, the Talmud says that in the many, many disputes between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, how do we know who to follow? We know we follow Beit Hillel, but how do we know how to follow Beit Hillel? So the Talmud says, because a bat kol said the halakha should be in accordance with the views of Beit Hillel. By the way, the reason that it gives is very, very fundamental as well. Because in terms of sharpness of mind and mental acuity, it is actually stated that Beit Shammai perhaps were more gifted intellectually, but the Beit Hillel were a deferential, humble, modest, and they always studied the dissenting views of Beit Shammai along with their own views. And because of that humility and modesty, the halacha follows the views of Beit Hillel. But your question is a very good question. If there's a rule of Lo Bashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, and if there's a rule that prophecy does not influence halacha, how can we, in fact, how can the Talmud indicate a bat kol establishes that halacha is like Beit Hillel? One argument might be public. The other argument is that the bat kol should be understood there as not creating the halachic rule. In point of fact, Beit Hillel was already a majority, and the bat kol is simply divine confirmation. For example, because you find the other one, if everyone knows, I'm sure, the famous story in the Gemara about the oven of Achnoi. This is a very well-known story. So if you remember the story, Rabbi Eliezer had an argument with the sages, and he refused to concede his position, and he called upon God to do many, many miracles to prove that he's right. He said, if the halacha is like me, let the tree fly away. And the tree flew away, and the Chachamim say, we don't listen to trees. If the halacha is like me, let the river reverse its course. And the river reverses its course, and they say, we don't listen to rivers. If the halacha is like me, let the walls of the Beit HaMidrash collapse. And the walls were about to collapse, and the other rabbi ordered them not to collapse, so the walls remained slanted. They didn't know who to listen to. And the Chachamim once again say, we do not listen to walls. And then, if you recall, he said, if the halacha is like me, let there be a bat kol. And a voice from heaven said, Rabbi Eliezer is right. And the Chachamim said, we don't even listen to heavenly voices. Because, in fact, Tosos asked the question, so how come the Beit Hillel? And the answer is, because Lo Bashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. Meaning, this is an extreme example that God himself has abdicated, volitionally, of course, because everything God does is volitional. God has abdicated control over the halakhic process. God has given us a Torah. He has given us the mechanisms of interpretation of that Torah, and now it's our gift. The analogy that is often given is the concept of God involving human beings with their minds and their intellect and their understanding in the creation of Torah is analogous to how a parent might want to make a cake for a child. Let's assume you want to make a cake for your 4-year-old's birthday. There are two ways you can do it. If you're interested in being efficient, you'll do it yourself. Do it when the kid's asleep. Do it in 20 minutes. It'll be over. But one of the ways you show your love for a child is not just by giving them the cake, but having them participate in the creation of that cake. So although the kitchen will be a mess, there may be, you know, 5 times the amount of sugar that you were going to put in, it's not going to be neat. It'll have lumps and bumps and everything else. But the love that is shown when you involve someone in the creative process is a much deeper level of love than if you simply give them a finished product. Torah is a collaborative partnership between God and man. And in a sense, God said, I did my part when I gave the Torah to Moshe. The rest is up to us. And as it were, prophecy, which is God's direct input, so to speak, now becomes irrelevant to the halachic process. And that's the Lo Bashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. Now there are parameters. Again, this doesn't mean to say that there are no boundaries. In other words, there are legitimate boundaries and parameters of how to interpret halacha, but be it as it may, prophecy has a very, very limited role. Now, truth of the matter is, this is one of Maimonides' favorite themes. As I say, he articulates this over and over and over again. Presumably, he has comparative religions in mind, because both Islam and certainly Christianity are predicated on the notion of the prophets being able to abrogate halakhic structures. And Maimonides felt very, very strongly that this was a matter that needed to be addressed and needed to be refuted. I will say that in later Kabbalistic and Hasidic literature, there is a little bit of a movement in the other direction. Rav Tzadok of Lublin, one of the great, great, profound Hasidic thinkers of the 19th century, he actually died in 1900, actually had a whole different view that prophecy may have much more of a powerful impact on halakha than perhaps is the case. But nevertheless, Maimonides' view, because of Maimonides' tremendous stature, has become the real mainstream view of how the halakhic process works, although there are some interesting dissenting voices. I don't want to get into too far afield, but Dr. Tamar Ras, a very eminent student of Jewish philosophy at Hebrew University, has actually argued that on some level the prophetic voice, which can emanate within the collective consciousness of Klal Yisrael, as Rav Cook talked about, might indicate certain issues of feminism and the like in terms of dealing with it in terms of halakha. She sees that as kind of a quasi-prophetic development, which is very intriguing, although it got her in a tremendous amount of trouble at a conference in New York. I attended with her. Okay, yeah.
So, how do you explain then if it's prophecy or anything
else? Or all the other prophecies? Oh, no, no, no. Okay, so let me clarify this. Maimonides certainly does not say prophecy ended with Moses. I mean, we have Yeshayahu, we have all those prophets. But he means to say that prophecy as a determiner of halakha ended with Moses, and therefore prophets predict the future, they give us guidance, they give us ethical teachings, but concrete halakha is beyond the realm of prophecy. And this is encapsulated in Lo Bashamayimi, the Torah's not in heaven. Now, what's very interesting is this. What's very interesting is, we actually have a work, well, let me give you a question. There are a lot of questions people ask. For example, very often in the Talmud there might be unresolved halakhic questions, and if you're familiar with the Talmudic terminology, the way the Talmud often ends off an unresolved question is by the word teiku. In fact, Rabbi Lewis Jacobs wrote a book, Teiku, in which he analyzed the appearance of this phrase. Now, there is a tradition, and it might be apocryphal, it's not clear that this is true, but there is a tradition that teiku is an abbreviation for, yeah, that's probably not true, they say, but because teiku literally means let the matter...
When they teach because
the reason is, the word teiku is a regular Aramaic word that just means the matter shall stand. I mean, it is a word, but there's a tradition, maybe a folk tradition, that it also refers to an abbreviation that says, Tishbi Yitaretz, Tishbi, Elijah the Tishbi, Elijah the prophet who will come before the Mashiach, Yitaretz will answer, will resolve, Kushyot, questions, Ubayot, and problems. Meaning to say, certain halachic matters are unresolved, we'll have to ask Elijah the prophet, who will be the repository of all secret knowledge. So the question is very simple. Why would Elijah the prophet be entitled to rule on these matters? He would be coming through prophecy, but prophecy, right, a Navi, cannot interpret halachic matters qua Navi, as a Navi, right? So this is a well-known question. So one answer is, well, Elijah has two hats. Elijah is a Navi, but he's also a great Torah scholar, right? So who says he's going to use the prophecy cap? He can also use the Chacham cap, right, the cap of Chacham. In other words, if I had, for example, let's assume that, in other words, a Navi is not disqualifying from being a halachic scholar. A Navi simply does not use Nevuah in the interpretation of halakha. So, for example, if my meat spoon fell into my dairy dish, I could ask Yeshayahu HaNavi what the halakha is, but he just wouldn't answer it by divine inspiration. He would have to answer it through the norms of halachic process. Now, another question that I'm just raising some just passages in the Talmud which raise the problem. In the beginning of Masechet Brachot is an interesting passage of a rabbi who entered, he had to daven mincha, he had to daven the afternoon service, so he entered an abandoned ruin, a building that was on the verge of falling apart. He wanted to get off the road to daven. And he bumped into Eliyahu HaNavi, who was making one of his visits to this earth. And Eliyahu HaNavi told him a halakha that you shouldn't daven in ruined buildings. And there were different reasons that were given. One is, if people see you go into this abandoned building, they'll think you're having an affair with somebody. There's kind of marit ayin, appearances of impropriety. Another reason is demons frequent these places, and what that means is a question. And the third reason is there is danger, buildings might collapse. And he says, from Eliyahu HaNavi, I learned this halacha. So once again, we're back to the same problem. How can a Navi be a transmitter of new halacha? So here, though, the answer that's given is a very interesting answer. We have to differentiate between a Navi that is teaching you halacha and a Navi that is simply alerting you to a fact. Meaning, in a sense, there is no new halachic principle that Eliyahu HaNavi is establishing. In other words, there's already a halacha. You avoid dangerous situations, and you avoid compromising situations. Eliyahu HaNavi is simply telling him, there's a risk this building may fall. Well, that's exactly the type of thing that prophets are good at. Prophets are good at telling you the future. So that is not a halachic principle that's being established. That is what is called mitziut, facts. And nevuah is certainly able to give you facts, even though nevuah cannot teach you halacha. But in principle, there's no new halachic principle Eliyahu HaNavi is articulating. So that's one thing about the idea of the very, very limited role of prophecy.
Can I ask a very quick question?
Sure.
Then what is the problem with the Navi Sheker? If he's not allowed to change halachic principles,
yeah,
and other than just, you know, encourage you to be good, the Navi Sheker is not going to encourage you to be...
Well, keep in mind, though, that there are a lot of other things a Navi can do. In other words, the inability of a Navi to change halacha does not exhaust what a Navi, for example, could tell you, wage war. I mean, let's take the examples of Navi Sheker in Yirmiyahu, where Yirmiyahu is calling upon the people to surrender to Babylon because they will not be successful. And the Navi Sheker says, fight. I mean, Navi Sheker could destroy a whole nation based on those messages. That's one point about the immutability of Torah, the very limited role of prophecy. But again, I'm not sure if Dr. Ross's paper was ever published, but it is a truly, truly phenomenal paper in which she does try to, it's based on Ruth Cook's writings and Ruth Sudduk's writings, in which she tries to talk about the role of prophetic, inspirational conception as having a bearing on the halachic process. Now, the other point I want to make is a prosaic point, but it's an important point because it's often misunderstood. And that is, on one hand, first of all, the Sefer HaIkarim, by the way, actually has many, many examples. It's a very controversial passage in which he does talk about things in the Torah as changing. And one of the examples he gives, very, very problematical example, is he claims, based on his interpretation of some Talmudic texts, that the Hebrew alphabet, all of us know that the Hebrew alphabet we have is not the original Hebrew alphabet, right? There is an older Hebrew alphabet, etc. I mean, everyone knows that that's true, but the Sefer HaIkarim actually maintains that, again, this is all based on a Talmudic discussion, that the writing that we have in a Sefer Torah, right, imagine the printing, the writing of the Sefer Torah, is given the designation Kitav Ashurit, which literally means Assyrian writing. Now, why does it have such an unusual designation of Kitav Ashurit? So Rav Albo quotes a passage in Tractate Sanhedrin that says, originally, the Torah was given to the Jewish people in what is called Kitav Ivri, in what is called Hebrew writing. Hebrew writing is the older Hebrew writing. But in the time of Ezra, as it were, because the Jews were living in Babylonia and they weren't familiar with regular Hebrew scripts, Ezra, this is just literally what the Gemara says, changed the Kitav by borrowing a Kitav of Assyrian writing or Babylonian writing, and that became the Kitav of the Sefer Torah. Now, standing alone, that's an astounding proposition, that what is called our sacred Hebrew alphabet was not the original Hebrew alphabet, and not only that, but it was not even the words of the Torah itself. The Torah were written in different letters, and he unilaterally changed the form of the alphabet in order to people would understand. This is Ezra, and that's called Ketav HaShirit. It was taken from Assyria, and Ezra made this change. So Rav Alba talks about issues like immutability. On the other hand, he is very, very severely criticized as not really understanding the intent of that passage. Again, the commentaries on that passage in Sanhedrin have a tremendous amount of difficulty conceptualizing the idea that the sacred words and the sacred letters were simply borrowed indiscriminately at a later date from another culture, and they offer another interpretation. And I'll share that with you in a moment. But let me just mention that they bring a very convincing proof against Rav Albo's thesis from the fact of the following. The Luchot, the Ten Commandments that were given to Moshe, according to rabbinic tradition, the letters could be read from both sides. The letters went through the entire Luchot. They could be read from the front, they could be read from the back. Not only that, but through a miracle, they could be read the same way, meaning you were not looking at the letters backwards, they were read forward both ways. So Rav Chisda, an Amora, says the following. Well, gee, if it was true that the Luchot could be read from both sides, then you have a problem with the final Mem and the final Samach. Why is this? Because the final Mem and a final Samach would have that little thing in the middle, like the hole of a donut. Meaning, how did that happen? So Rav Chisda actually says, Mem, the Samach Sheba Luchot, the final Mem and the final Samach in the Luchot must have been suspended by a miracle. But the argument against Rav Albo's thesis is this. If we posit that the Luchot were originally written in Ketav Ivri, in the Hebrew, the old Hebrew script, and not Ketav HaShirit, the characteristics of the final Mem and the final Samach do not exist in the Ketav Ivri. So you have a proof, in other words, that the Torah was given in our Ketav originally. So the interpretation that the commentaries give is very different than Albo's, and they interpret the following. They interpret that certainly our language, our letters, our Hebrew script, was certainly the language of the Torah. It was the language of the Luchot. It was the letters by which God created the world. That always was the sacred language. However, there was a concept in which we differentiated between a sacred alphabet and an everyday alphabet, meaning the Ketav HaShirit was reserved for the special sacred Sefer Torah that was in the Ark and the Luchot, the tablets, but for everyday speech or everyday writing, people employed the regular Ketav Ivri. So Ezra's innovation, this is not the Albo position, Ezra's innovation was not in simply changing the alphabet, but in allowing the sacred script to be used for everyday uses, and therefore the term Ashurit should be interpreted not as Assyrian, it's a little bit of a twist of the word here, but rather from the word Osher. Osher is the fortunate script, the gifted script, the happy script. It's Musheret Shebiktav. Right, so being a man, it's kind of a very interesting debate regarding the change of the Hebrew letters and the like. Another question that's asked on the immutability of Torah is a verse in Yirmiyahu, because when God talks about the future redemption, right, the future, then God says, there shall come a time when people will no longer say, blessed be God who took us out of Egypt, but instead they will say, blessed be God that it gathered our exiles from the four corners of the world. Meaning it seems to suggest that the messianic redemption will be so much greater than the Egyptian redemption that we will no longer be talking about the Egyptian redemption. That's the simple meaning of the verse in Jeremiah. Rav Albo points out, wait a second here. There's a mitzvah in the Torah that says, you shall remember the Exodus of Egypt. Is there a suggestion that that mitzvah is going to be abrogated? Right? We're dealing with changes. So again, there are different answers. Well, the answer might be, it doesn't mean we'll forget about Mitzrayim. It just means we'll emphasize the new one. It doesn't mean we'll get rid of the old one. But the Bible has a whole list of different things in which we might find potential changes. So that's something just to be aware of. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Ezra's motivation presumably was Ezra confronted a society that was in great need of religious revival. There was a lot of intermarriage that was rampant, and I think Ezra felt that somehow spiritually connecting to the sacred letters would have had a spiritual effect. In fact, it's brought down in Kabbalistic literature. It's interesting that Ezra's not noted as a Kabbalist per se, that one should endeavor, I don't know if you've ever seen this, one should endeavor to daven from a sidur in which the typeface is the kitab that you have in a sacred Torah. You can get such a sidur. In other words, a sidur that's the kitab ashirit, so exactly with the crowns and everything else. So it could very well be that that, in fact, was Ezra's motivation, that people should be inspired that way.
I'm just confused about one thing. The Kitab Ivri was the Hebrew writing.
Yes.
Yet you said the one with the crowns is the Ashuri.
That's correct.
See, I guess I followed it, but it
just switched
in my mind.
No, you have to understand. Kitab Ivri does not refer to our Hebrew alphabet at all. Kitab Ivri is the term the Talmud uses for the ancient. If you ever look at a good Hebrew dictionary, so you'll see with every letter there's an older version. Kitab Ivri is the Talmudic term for the ancient, now obsolete Hebrew script. Our Hebrew alphabet is technically Kitab Ashurit, and even though we may print it without the crowns, that's just a variation of Kitab Ashurit. So our modern Hebrew alphabet is what the Talmud calls Kitab Ashurit.
Is there any explanation of what those crowns mean other than that little story about Moses?
Well, that's the whole point of the story, that there are many, many hidden meanings. There is a there are midrashim. There are, in fact, there's a midrash that is called Otiyot Rabbi Akiva, the letters of Rabbi Akiva, which Rabbi Akiva explains a number of the tagim. But certainly there are many, many mysteries that we have not fathomed entirely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure. I had thought that much of the Dead Sea Scroll material was in fact in Kitab Ashurit, but
I
might be wrong. It's old. I mean, we know what the Kitab Ivri is. Again, as I say, if you look in many Hebrew dictionaries, alongside, it's an ancient variant of Hebrew that's actually, it bears a closer resemblance to Phoenician and a type of hieroglyphic as well. It's similar to even Egyptian hieroglyphics. It's an ancient.
I have an Aramaic scholar about that. Yeah. What a coincidence that Aramaic is written in the same letters. Well,
yeah.
Not that Aramaic is written in Hebrew letters. It's more accurate to say that Hebrew modern Hebrew is written.
Well, that's going with the Kitab, that's going with Alvo's idea, Kitab Ashurit. Yeah. In other words, it would depend on that. Yeah, well, but you see, there is a debate, yes, even in traditional sources, based on the passage in the Talmud, if Kitab Ashurit, if in fact our writing is. But again, the mainstream commentaries find Alvo's position to be theologically untenable, simply because it would seem to detract greatly from the mystical and spiritual and transcendent significance of the Hebrew letters. Now, letters, particularly in Kabbalah, are very, very significant. The shapes of the letters, etc. And just to say it was a wholesale incorporation from Assyria would tend to rob it of its great sanctity. Now, another point I want to make, again, just to familiarize people with things, that Maimonides' idea, and Albo's idea as well, of Torah min Hashamayim, that the Torah came from God and will never be changed, cannot be changed. One just has to understand this a little bit, because there are two phrases that people sometimes confuse, which in fact are very, very different. One is Torah min Hashamayim, the Torah came from God, from heaven. The other is Torah mi Sinai, the Torah was given to Moshe on Mount Sinai. Now, let me just explain this a little bit, because the concept that Moshe got the whole Torah on Mount Sinai seems to have the following just very historical difficulty. Moses is on Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20. Right? Exodus chapter 20, he goes up to Mount Sinai, he's there for 40 days. And under our tradition, that's when he got the Torah. He comes down, he breaks the tablets, he goes up again, he comes down by Yom Kippur. Right? Now, the problem is, how do we understand all of the events and stories in the Torah that occur after Moshe came down from Mount Sinai. The story of the spies, the book of Deuteronomy, the building of the Mishkan. Did Moshe come down with that Torah? Did people get a script? Like, did Moshe hand out a script and say, in around a year, 10 of you 12 guys are going to come back with this real negative report? So, do your method acting. In other words, you say how bad Israel is, and you two come back and say how good it is. In other words, what is the concept of, how do you simply understand the idea that historically, the historical unfolding of the events in the five books of Moses, much of which take place after the pivotal event of Matan Torah. So how could the Torah be given to Moshe on Mount Sinai? So the answer is really very, very simple. The answer is, we don't know what Moshe knew privately. Moshe privately may have known everything that was going to happen. But in terms of the Jewish people, it's very, very clear that the most God may have given Moses were the commandments to tell the Jewish people. But the narrative documents that is known as the five books of Moses, the narration of the Torah it was not completed until right before Moshe's death. Now there's an argument in the Gemara, how did Moshe write the Torah? Did Moshe write the events as they happened? So after the spies, he wrote down the story of the spies. After Korach, he wrote down the story of Korach. After Miriam died, he wrote down the story of Miriam. Or did Moshe not write any of the Torah until right before his death, in which case he wrote the whole thing? Now, according to our opinions, it was in the matter of dictation. God told him, you know, what to write. But nevertheless, one should recognize that the mitzvot may have been given on Sinai, but the narrative document of the five books of Moses was either written as it happened. This is a phrase that the Gemara says is Torah Megillah Megillah Nitna. The Torah was given piecemeal, a scroll at a time. Or Torah Chatuma Nitna, which means the Torah was written as a completed work. So no one should think that Moshe came down from Mount Sinai with a Sefer Torah. That absolutely is not the case. He came down with Luchot and Mitzvot, but the events happened as they happened. Therefore, the idea of Moshe getting the Torah Misinai is not the same as getting the Sefer Torah Misinai. The Sefer Torah was written either as it happened or at the end of the 40 years. And in fact, there's an interesting discussion in the Gemara, who wrote the last 8 verses of the Torah? Because the problem is, the last 8 verses says that Moses died. Did Moses write and Moses died? So according to one opinion, Moses wrote everything with tears in his eyes. And according to another opinion, Joshua actually finished those last 8 verses. But actually there's a beautiful interpretation of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon says, what does it say? It says Moses wrote the Torah. If you say Moses wrote those last 8 verses, he wrote those verses bedema. Dema means with tears. Why say tears? So the Vilna Gaon says the following. He offers an amazing retranslation of dema. The word dema in rabbinic literature can mean tears, but it can also mean a jumble or mix-up. What do we mean? There is a concept, and actually with the Bible codes, this concept has come to the forefront, that in addition to the division of the Torah into words, there's a transcendent inner meaning through a sequencing of letters that's independent of the words. We say, for example, the Torah existed before the creation of the world. Now, before the creation of the world, there's no need to talk about don't kill, don't steal, don't eat meat and milk, or don't cook a kid in his mother's milk. So in what form? The Torah existed before the creation of the world in black fire on white fire, the primeval Torah. What is the primeval Torah? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, writes, the primeval Torah is an unbroken sequence of letters, not yet divided into the words which apply to the contemporary human condition. And the sequence of those letters represents the totality of the divine name. Right, we talk about God has a 4-letter name, God has a 5-letter name, God has a 305,000-letter name. And that is the Torah. And the Ramban writes, and that is why when a Sefer Torah misses one letter, the Torah is pasul. Why is that? You could be missing a letter and it doesn't change a meaning. Aharon is occasionally spelt with a vav after the resh. But without the vav, it's the same word. The meaning in the prose sense, has not changed, but it no longer represents the divinity. The divinity has been impaired. So, this is the dilemma. How could Moshe write the last eight verses if he writes, and Moses died, it's alive? Answer, he wrote it in its primeval form, Dema. He wrote the last eight verses in the unbroken sequence of letters. So, and it was only Joshua who split it up. So in effect, every word of the Torah was written by Moshe, but he didn't write a lie, because he wrote those last eight verses, Bidema, the unbroken sequence of letters. That's the Vilna Gaon's translation of the idea of Bidema. But this is really a very, very powerful idea. And again, with the Bible codes, we see a scientific, well, I don't want to say scientific, because some say it's not scientific, but we see, according to some, at least a popular confirmation of the idea that there are layers of meaning. And the truth is, I mean, regardless of the particular conclusions, which you can dispute, but it's a non-controversial idea that indeed, in letters and numerical equivalents and gematrias and all sorts of other ways of reading beneath the text, there are layers of meaning that go beyond what the words say.
I'm puzzled about one thing.
Yeah.
How could Moses have done that, writing it, even though the letters stuck together, unless he didn't know what it meant? Because he's saying in that text something about his own humility, about how he was the most humble.
Well, once again, according to the Vilna Gaon, perhaps he didn't know. God just said, write these letters. Or perhaps he knew, but he was bidden to do what God said, right? I mean, after all, it does say in the book of Numbers, when Miriam got leprosy, that's where it says, and the man Moses was the most humble of all who walked the earth. So he had to write that down. So there, you know, there it's worse, you know. So the answer is, when you're a truly humble person, you do what God tells you to do, even if it means writing that you're a humble person. That's what God said. You know, when a person protests too much, sometimes that's a sign of arrogance in and of itself. That's the story that Chabad has a story they like to tell about Hasidim and Misnagdim, about a chassid who came to town and he wanted to show the Misnagdim that they weren't as spiritual as they thought. So, you know, in Simchat Torah we have the Hakafot, right, everyone there. So he just took over the show. You know, they announced, you know, this Hakafah is for Kohanim, this Hakafah is for different people. So he got up and he said, this hakafah is for the humble people of the show. So of course the story goes, everybody was fighting. You think you're modest? Who do you think you are? You know, so they were fighting over that whole thing. Okay, so, I'm sorry, yeah. No, well, okay, in other words, in Hebrew, dema is tearing, tear. But in Aramaic, in Mishnaic Hebrew, the word dema comes from, dema is a separate Aramaic shoresh that means mixing or jumbling. So for example, when something treif gets mixed in with something kosher, that is called a dimua. Again, it doesn't correspond with modern or biblical Hebrew, but it is a Mishnaic formulation. Interesting. I'm not sure, because Dam, of course, is Dalad Mem. This has an ayin in it, Dalad Mem ayin, but perhaps it's connected, that the blood is a mixture of different elements that come together. That very well might be so. All right, so that was the idea of the immutability of Torah. Now, I have some comments on the next area, and that is God's knowledge, right? God knows all of the ma'aseh b'nei Adam, all that people do. Now, it's very interesting. And this is fascinating, because this would not even appear to the modern mind as being a philosophical problem. But to the medieval mind, this was an amazingly difficult issue. And let me explain why. I mean, it's hard to explain. That it was thought that God's knowing things is a contradiction to God's absolute unity. How is that so? Because knowledge connotes a change. Why is this? God cannot know that something exists until it exists. Because if it doesn't, in other words, because the knowledge would be false. Meaning to say that if God creates something today that didn't exist yesterday, then yesterday God did not know that this thing existed, because it didn't exist. Right? So God knows only when it happens. Again, I don't want to be confusing. I don't mean to say God doesn't know the future. God knows the future. But the question is, God does not know that something presently exists until it presently exists, because that would be impossible. Because if it doesn't presently exist, God cannot know that it presently exists. Knowledge, therefore, connotes the capacity of change within an entity. I know something today that I didn't know yesterday. But that contradicts the notion of the unchangeability of God, because knowledge involves change. So the question then becomes, what's the alternative? God doesn't know what's going on? That connotes imperfection. So our dilemma is, do we posit the absolute unity of God that is imperfect? Or do we posit the absolute perfection of God, which is multiplicity? Okay, this is a typical medieval philosophical question. I don't think it rips us apart, so to speak. I don't think it's a type of question that we can't sleep at night. But for many of the philosophers, the idea of God knowing the changing vagaries of existence involved a change in what God knew today and what God knows tomorrow, and therefore that involves, that's a contradiction to the assertion of unity. So Maimonides' answer to this was essentially a take-up, in a sense, and he said, and this is why, and actually with this background you understand some phraseology, and sometimes you read a phrase in the Rambam and you're not sure, like, why does he say this? Like, the Rambam says in a lot of places, God's knowledge and God's essence are one. And God's knowledge is not like human knowledge, which is something apart from the person, but it is part of God's unchangeable essence. Like, what is he getting at? What he's getting at, not that I have any brilliant explanation for it, but what he's getting at is he's getting at that precise question of whether knowledge is a function of change and therefore reflects on a changeable essence. And the short answer was, since we don't understand God's essence and God's knowledge is the same as God's essence, therefore we don't understand God's knowledge, but it is not analogous to human knowledge. And this is where Maimonides actually develops the very famous idea of the negative attributes. The Kuzri says this as well. The Kuzri actually said it before the Rambam. The negative attribute is, any positive affirmation of God is nothing more than a statement that God lacks the negative. So when we say God knows, that just means God is not ignorant. In other words, we can't say what it means that God knows, but we can say he doesn't have the inadequacy of not knowing. Right? That's the idea of the negative attribute. Yeah.
Without going to that place, the negative attributes, it's a turning turn on the nature of time. That is, if we imagine, if we take time out of the issue in terms of an existing object, then God knows that object exists now.
Yes.
God knows that object exists in some time.
Yes.
And time seems to be enough of a human construct that it doesn't make a contradiction.
Yes, that in fact
is like a friendly king of France involved.
Right.
You talk about that because it's a positive tradition of philosophy, but how could that statement come to fall? So it's your one.
Right.
Because there is no friendly king of France.
Right.
That sort of thing.
Right.
So from an eternal standpoint, statements about existence could be true and known to be true without implying a change.
Yes, in fact, Maimonides makes the point in the Mishneh Torah in particular that because God is above the limitations of time, the concept that things change with the passage of time is an irrelevant concept because God is existing in all dimensions simultaneously. And therefore, God's knowledge of what will be true in the future is a present knowledge of something that is presently, we can't even use the word, but it's something that is existing concurrently with God's essence, and therefore there's no particular problem. Again, this is a metaphysical problem, which again, indeed, is a serious problem, but again, it's something that we would need, I think, a deeper grounding in technical philosophy to appreciate. But there's another fundamental issue about God's knowledge that is a very, very real theological concern, and that is the impact of God's well, first of all, let me just say, the logical predicate that God knows what people do, Maimonides argues, is the institution of reward and punishment. Meaning to say, that God could not possibly reward virtue, whether this world or the other world. How God rewards is another problem, but God could not reward virtue or punish evil unless God is, of course, aware of virtue and evil, and consequently, reward and punishment presuppose the notion of divine knowledge. There would be no purpose in praying to God unless God knew what was going on. So consequently, and also the other argument would be that ignorance is imperfection, ignorance is lack, ignorance is chisaron, and the perfection of God, right, the unity was the problem, but the perfection of God also entails perfect omniscience knowledge, right? So the two groundings are the logic of schar v'onesh and the inescapable conclusion based on the perfection of the Creator. However, the philosophical argument is, how do we reconcile omniscience, total knowledge of past, present, and future, with the capacities of human choice? And again, it is true, of course, that Maimonides does not mention free will as one of the 13 principles of faith. That much is true. But nevertheless, it is certainly a fundamental principle. He articulates it in many other contexts. It is a derivative principle, as Revolvo says, from reward and punishment. Same idea. There can't be reward and punishment unless I have choice. If I don't have choice, if I have to do what I do, then what is the morality of God to give me sanctions? Or what's the basis of reward, right? You don't reward, you don't pat your computer on the back when the computer does what it's programmed to do. Although computers seem to have the capacity of free will, but as far as we know, it's not entirely there, right? So here's the question, right? This is one of the famous philosophical conundrums, which I think is a question that indeed bothers many, many people. And that is, on one hand, Maimonides says, and that's not even the Khuzri, the Ikrim, everybody says this, that it's fundamental to Judaism, that Judaism is predicated on free will, on choice, on the fact, as Chazal say, the Gemara tells us, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything that happens to us, you know, God decrees, healthy, sick, etc., chutz mi yirat shamayim, but the decision to be a God-fearing person and obey God's will is up to us. God does not decree that we will be righteous, and God does not decree that we will be evil. Every human being has the capacity to be a righteous person. Every human being has the capacity to be an evil person. It's up to us. God ties his hands, and God does not interfere, except in rare instances, which we'll talk about shortly, in human choice. Right, this is fundamental. This is called Bechira, and the Rambam has a long essay against the error of many Islamic philosophers, and later Calvinists in the post-Reformation, which talked about predestination, predetermination, and the like, and Maimonides said that would be unjust, that it would be illogical, and therefore it would be impossible. So the question then becomes, well, on one end we have this idea that God knows exactly what I'm going to do. God knows if I'm going to kill somebody today, or God knows if I'm going to eat non-kosher food, or God knows if I'm going to yell at my wife, and yet every morning that I get up, we are told that I have the free will to do what I want to do. So the question becomes, if God knows I'm going to do something, do I have the free will not to do it the next day? Right? This is the well-known contradiction or conundrum between what is called yidiyah, God's knowledge, God's omniscience, and bechira, which is the autonomy of human choice. Once again, Maimonides suggests a somewhat complicated answer that is based on God being above time, meaning to say that I have choice vis-a-vis the human perspective of the future not yet being here. Well, the future's not here, so what I do in the future has been undetermined as future, but from the vantage point of an entity existing above time, essentially the future has already happened, and Maimonides then concludes that since we don't know how God does this, we can't fully answer the question. Well, there's a simultaneous existing in all time. The Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, who was Maimonides' great critic, actually has some very harsh words for the Rambam. He says, if you couldn't answer the question, don't ask it. the Rambam tried to answer the question, but he felt that this was a philosophical answer that many people can't really understand. The Ravid gives a different answer, a very startling answer. in which he posits that God's omniscience is in the nature of prediction. I'll give you an example. Let's assume you have a child, or you have your husband, your wife, whatever it is. You can predict how your husband or your wife or your child will typically respond to a whole bunch of situations simply because you know them well. Now, your accuracy is not going to be 100% because we don't know people that well. But God, who knows us so well, in effect, will have perfect predictive accuracy of 100%. So God does not mandate the choice. God does not dictate the choice. God does not decree the choice. God simply guesses the choice. But God's guess is going to be right, because with perfect knowledge, there would be an accuracy of prediction. That's a very, very big chidush, in the sense that God is predicting the same way that a parent predicts, but God will always be right, simply because God's prediction has a higher measure of accuracy. Well, yeah, that also is a very good question, because if, in fact, the way we respond to a situation is a total function of what we've done in the past, then do we have a realistic prediction? It's a good question. I mean, but he's differentiating. God knows what we'll do, but we still can decide to do it. That's a very mechanistic view of human nature.
That's very much putting God in the same realm as the people. So he's always
going to
be right.
Well, it's diminishing God's. But again, the rabbi is trying to preserve the idea of free will. Now, Pirkei Avot, by the way, this was identified as a problem well before medieval philosophy. It was identified as a problem in classic rabbinic literature, and Pirkei Avot encapsulates in a little epigram that says, "Hakol Tzafoi." Everything is predicted, everything is known, Urishut Metuna, but permission is given to make your choices. But that's the dilemma of Hakol Tzafoi, Urishut Metuna. But in his discussion of free will, Maimonides, and again I'm quoting Maimonides heavily because he devotes the most time on this very major problem, Maimonides raises a number of questions. One of the questions is the famous question of God hardening Paro's heart. Like one of the famous questions that God hardens Paro's heart so he does not send out the Jewish people, and then God uses that as the basis for bringing more and more plagues upon Paro. Is it unfair? The implication of the verse seems to be that Paro would have let the Jewish people out, but God made Paro be resistant. What do we do with that? So Maimonides himself gives the very famous answer. He just famous passages that one should be aware of. That is, he says that there is a concept that part of how a human being could be punished by God is that they could lose their capacity for free will. And therefore he points out it is notable that for the first five plagues it does not say God hardened Pharaoh's heart. It says Pharaoh hardened his heart. But over and over again, repeatedly rejecting God, repeatedly disobeying God, eventually a human being can lose the capacity of the free will. But he could then be punished for his loss of that capacity. Because the loss of that capacity came from the exercise of free will. Right? The analogy would be intoxication. Let's assume somebody is totally drunk and they get into an automobile. Even legally, this is true, and they kill somebody, right? So they can go to jail for even for murder. So the question is, I couldn't help myself. I was totally drunk. I was not responsible for my actions. I was beyond the point of self-control. Yes, you were beyond the point of self-control, but you put yourself in that situation. Paro may have been beyond free will, but he put himself beyond free will by the exercise of his free will. Right? The analogy is addiction, all addiction, and we understand this. A person might indeed put themselves beyond the ability to control themselves, but there's accountability for putting yourself in that situation.
Well, maybe that goes back to the idea about prediction. In other words, maybe it was that God could predict after the first time, five times anyway, that Pharaoh would continue to react in this way. So even though he might not have forced him into doing it, because he still had free will, the prediction was that if I continue to punish, he will continue to harden.
But then I don't think the Torah would describe it as God hardens Pharaoh's heart.
Well,
but
by the action of bringing another plague, he knew in advance that that was going to.
Yes, but would it say that God hardened Pharaoh's heart?
Yeah, because after the first. It took five times for it to finally become that hard.
Right.
So that then it was God's hardening, because God continued to bring the plague, and Pharaoh continued in the way that he had continued for the first five times. So he knew that. So at this point, it could look as if God was hardening his heart.
But again, according to your interpretation, it doesn't mean that God overrode Pharaoh's free will. You're just saying that God knew that Pharaoh would
because otherwise it's a real problem. I know what you were saying is that, you know, at some point God can override free will, but then you have the whole philosophical question of how often does this happen and who does it
happen?
And then
is
anybody
accountable
for what they've done?
Well, you know, once again, the assumption is that at the point in which one loses the capacity of free will because of their volition, then there's full accountability even to the loss of control, because they put themselves in that situation. This is the Rambam's answer, and of course we see it ourselves. That we see the notion that this is why tshuva. Now again, this doesn't mean tshuva is impossible, but it means that things get harder and harder and harder. We get addicted to destructive patterns of behavior.
action is that God does not allow you to do repentance. And one of them is if someone says, I will sin now and I'll do tshuva on Yom Kippur. So it says on that that God will not allow that person to do tshuva. It's very similar to hardening one's heart and not allowing that husband.
That's not allowing doesn't mean if they do tshuva, they won't be accepted, but they're not going to have the emotional ability and will to do it. You lose that will. And we know this. We know that the actions that we do redefine and impair and taint and destroy our character, and we find ourselves unable to do things that we might have been able to do at an earlier stage.
And they would say that was attributable to God overriding?
Yes. In effect, God, in other words, you can look at it this way, that God allows you to bear the consequences of the destructive acts you've done to yourself. And so, in fact, God has taken those gifts away from you. Now, there's another answer, by the way, the Maharal gives. I just want to share you a much later answer. Maharal gives a very, very nice answer to this, God hardening Paro's heart. The Maharal, who lived in 16th century Prague, again, Maharal is not per se part of the course here, but the Maharal is a very, very interesting, what you would call, transitional figure. He was at the beginning of the Renaissance, and he was quite involved in the science and philosophy of his time, but he was also a mystic and a Mekubal, and in his works there's an attempt to really integrate the rationalist philosophy of the Rambam and Revalvo with the mystical ideas of the Ari and the Zohar, together with the emerging science of the Renaissance. So the Maharal actually combines all of those different fields. But in this particular issue, he says the following. He says, who says hardening Paro's heart is overriding free will? Maybe it's the opposite. Because the truth of the matter is, with all of those hard plagues, that would have destroyed his will. So the heart, in other words, that would have forced him to let the Jews out, even if it's not what he really wants to do. The Maharal says, the hardening of Paro's heart is to make him resistant and impervious to external pressure. So psychologically, he decides exactly what it is he wants to do. Maharal says, the hardening of Paro's heart was an assurance of true will. Because had his heart not been hardened, he would have been forced into doing what he really didn't want to do. God says, I'm going to give you a chance to make your choice totally objectively.
Like hitting rock bottom.
That's right. That's right. But essentially, he gave Paro an extraordinary amount of toughness to see, to allow him to make the decision on the level of free will. Now that itself is a punishment though, because normally God allows us to be responsive to external stimuli, to bring us to tshuva. That gift he took away from Paro, and Paro was the only person who actually made the decision based on his own objective desires.
He lost his heart. He totally...
That's correct. The heart does not respond to the outside.
With
your desires and not some external constraint. That's the Maharal's idea. Now, but then though, I want to get into another thing here, because the Rambam then asks another question. And again, I know that we're not supposed to talk about the Rambam as much as I'm doing today, but this is such important material that there is a need to cover it. And that is, the Rambam raises the question of the covenant between the parts. Like we read in the Torah's reading 2 weeks ago, that God told Abraham, remember that the animals were split, and that's the way they used to make a covenant. People would walk through the split animal as if to become one. And God said to Abraham, you shall know that your children will be enslaved, will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and that nation will enslave them and afflict them for 400 years. And then God says, and the nation that afflicts them I shall judge, and your people will leave that land with great wealth. This is a prophecy, a divine communication, that there will be an avdut, there will be a galut, there will be an exile and a slavery and an affliction in a land that is not theirs. It doesn't mention Egypt particularly, but this is a foreshadowing of the Egyptian exile. It was said to be for a duration of 400 years, although in fact they were only there 210 years. And then part of the divine directive is that the nation that enslaves them will be judged and punished. So Maimonides raises this question. How could the Egyptians be judged and punished for what they did to the Jewish people if what they did to the Jewish people was decreed by God? This, of course, would be a problem with all types of oppression. If things that happened, God must have willed them to happen. So Maimonides gives the following answer. Maimonides' answer was, God did not decree that Egypt specifically would enslave the Jewish people. God said, a nation that is not theirs. So Egypt was not told they had to do it, nor was there any individual person who was told to enslave the Jewish people. Therefore, anyone that enslaves the Jewish people had free will to do it or not to do it. Anyone that hurt another Jew or another person had free will to do it or not to do it. Since the Gezeirah of Hashem, the decree of God, was not on an Am Yadua, a specifically identified nation, nor was there a Gezeirah on any Yachid, any individual, accountability, punishment, condemnation can exist for anyone who through their Bechira decided to do what they did. Now this is what Maimonides writes in the Mishneh Torah. Nachmanides says he doesn't see the logic of the Rambam. Because let's assume a king says, anyone who apprehends this criminal will get a reward. I apprehend the criminal. I claim the reward. The king says, oh, I didn't decree that you should do it. I decreed anybody should do it. You're not anybody. You're not the specific person. But his answer is, well, you didn't say I should do it, but you said someone should do it. Is the someone who should have done it somebody who didn't do it? In other words, who did Hashem decree should do it? The only person who is the anyone is the person who doesn't do it? In other words, Ramban's argument is that, so what? God didn't decree that Egypt do it. God decreed somebody should do it. If Egypt is the somebody, why shouldn't they get reward from God instead of condemnation? I'll come back to this. I mean, the truth is that it could very well be that the Rambam was addressing a different question than Nachmanides. But so look at Nachmanides gives two answers. Nachmanides gives his own answers. Again, the question is, what is the morality of punishing Egypt if God decreed that they would persecute the Jews? So he gives two answers. Answer number one focuses on subjective intent. And that is to say, yes, there may have been a divine decree to persecute or enslave the Jewish people, but the Egyptians that did the enslaving did not do so in order to fulfill the divine decree. The proof of the pudding is, Paro denied that there was a divinity. Remember when Moshe comes to Paro and he says, God says, let my people go. So Paro's response is, he checked his list, Paro had a list of all the deities in the world, and he said, Mi Hashem asher eshma b'kolo. Who is this God that I should listen to him? He's not on my list. Or even if he was, he was just another national god, like all the gods, all the nations had their gods. So one could not say Paro is, as it were, doing what he's doing because he's in submission to the will of God. And therefore, Nachmanides argues, intention is a crucial idea here. That even if in some sense whatever you're carrying out was the will of God, but if one's intention is for their own cruelty, their own desire to inflict pain, their own selfishness, there could be a punishment for that. It's reminiscent, just comes to me, although it's not really relevant, but there are cases in the courts sometimes involving agunot, where women do not get the religious divorces. And sometimes courts have actually ordered husbands to give a get to their wives. And the husbands sometimes make the argument To force me to give a get is a violation of my freedom of religion, because you're forcing me to practice religion. So sometimes the judge's response is, don't say that the reason you're not giving a get is because, you know, it's your religious observance. You're doing it to get money, or you're doing it to be mean. Meaning, you can't argue that you're doing something because of a religious reason, when in fact the motivation is transparently the other way. Paro is not doing what he's doing because of some religious obedience to God. It's his own bechira. That's the first answer Nachmanides gives.
How Aaron informs the Israelites, because first of all, if the Egyptians were responsible to fulfill God's word, well, that would have been the proper way of doing it, and God would have sent the prophets to the Egyptians. They would have told Abraham, they would have told some prophet in Egypt. Secondly, there's another problem in that when the Egyptians took Israel in, they, even if Abraham would have told them, well, there was this prophecy that he'd be enslaved,
right,
the Jews would have instantly handed themselves over to go into slavery, because Abraham had a vision that they would one day be slaves. So I don't understand what the Ramban really expected of the Egyptians in order to do this in a proper way. I don't know how you can subject people to cruelty in a proper way.
You're asking what would have been a legitimate way for them to do it?
That
really comes to a second answer. I mean, the Ramban does say, for example, that if somebody got a direct prophecy from God that someone should be put to death, and I put him to death because of the word of the prophet, that would be legitimate. Now, but let me give you a second answer. The second answer addresses what you're saying, but the second answer is enormously problematic in terms of God's knowledge. And that is, the Ramban gives a second answer, that the issue of Mitzrayim was not the issue of motivation only, but the issue was they went beyond the parameters of the divine decree. God did decree there would be servitude and affliction, but the Egyptians did more than God had decreed. The killing of the babies was not in the decree. Now, what the Ramban is suggesting is that evil can be perpetrated in the world beyond the parameters of God's specific will. Now, we do know one of the fundamental theological issues in any religion, in religious life, all religions, is the issue of theodicy. Theodicy is the problem of, why do bad things happen to good people? There's also a question, why do good things happen to bad people? Which is a secondary question. More people ask the first question. Although, as Ramban points out a bit sarcastically, no one ever asks, why do good things happen to me? We don't ask that particular question. But be it as it may, the issue of evil is a very, very powerful one. It seems to contradict to the idea of God's perfection, which connotes God's justice as well as God's mercy, etc. Right? So this is a very difficult problem. The book of Job is about this. According to rabbinic tradition, when Moses asked God, show me your ways, this was the very specific question that Moshe wanted to know. Why do righteous people suffer in the world? But what the Ramban is teaching us is, in a way, this doesn't answer everything. This doesn't answer volcanoes and hurricanes. This is everything. But what the Ramban is saying is, when human beings are victimized by human beings, that is sometimes the inevitable fallout of the autonomy of free will. The ability of free will. Now, why is there free will in the world? Why do we have free will? Free will, we understand. Free will, the Rambam says, is a predicate for goodness. Goodness is goodness only when it is chosen. If you don't choose goodness, then your goodness is not truly good. Therefore, God created a world of choice in which God abdicates his control over that decision. But there's a fallout. If God abdicates his control over our moral decision-making processes, then indeed our decision-making processes can veer to any extreme. And as a result, if some kid decides he's going to murder somebody tonight, and you happen to be in the way, at least the Ramban, many would disagree with this analysis, then it's not that God decreed your time has come, but simply you are in the range of somebody's autonomous bechira. Now, again, this is a very, very difficult proposition, and some do not agree with this, but some would understand even tragedies like the Holocaust in the sense of declaring much more about the human condition than about the divine condition, that it really tells us what a world is like when human beings make choices that are evil, and God chooses at times not to intervene in those choices. So it's not that God decrees, but God does not intervene. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've got a problem. You know, when we are talking about the fact that God, the country is not mentioned, in other words,
yes.
Egypt is not
mentioned.
Eretz
Lo-Lahem, right.
Right. And then also, when you talked about affliction and what degree of affliction,
yeah.
There are no specific, you know, hot hearts or sparrow or whatever. This is not specified either.
Yeah, so how do you, again, it's the same problem as raised before. How are the Egyptians supposed to know if they're within the limits or whatever?
Exactly.
That? Yeah.
I mean, I don't agree with the Rambam.
With the Rambam?
Okay.
Okay.
And I tend to agree more with the Rambam,
Well, the Ramban's point, though, is a very, very, very powerful and difficult point, and a controversial point also in the history of Jewish philosophy. And that is, the normal understanding, which is enormously complicated in and of itself, but the normal understanding of the relationship between God's omniscience and free will is the concept of the following. God does not tell you if you're going to shoot somebody or not. That's your choice. But if you've decided to shoot somebody, God will ensure that the person who's on the other side of the bullet is the person that God has decreed should die. Now, I don't mean because of his sin. That's a separate thing, but his time has come. Well, whatever the reason is, that no one's going to die unless it was God's will at that moment the person died. Ramban is suggesting that that's not necessarily the case. Ramban is suggesting that the powerful principle of free will, which is a fundamental elemental force in the moral universe, allows the consequences of the bechira to go beyond any specific divine will. God's omniscience is still there. God's knowledge of what's going to happen is still there. But it's not a gezeirah. Now, let me just share with you another stuff from the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Or HaChaim is a very famous commentary on the Chumash, which he was a great Kabbalist, and it's surprisingly that he makes the identical point of the Ramban, which is decidedly not in the Kabbalistic tradition, where God decrees, you know, every blade of grass. But he said the following striking comment. We're going to read in a few weeks about the story of Yosef. And Yosef gets thrown into the pit. Now, if you remember, Reuven said, let's not kill Yosef, let's throw him in the pit. So the Or HaChaim raises the following question. According to rabbinic tradition, the pit in which Yosef was thrown contained snakes and scorpions. Now, if your attitude is, we don't want to kill you, we'll just throw you into a pit full of poisonous snakes and scorpions, that's the same as killing. Now, one answer might be, well, they didn't know. Like, you know, but the Or HaChaim gives the following argument. Listen to what he says. He says the following. The truth of the matter is, the brothers actually had a halachic justification that Yosef deserved to die. It was kind of a vigilante court. Why did they feel Yosef deserved to die? Because they saw a potential repetition of a pattern that had already occurred. Abraham had two children, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Yishmael gets excluded from the spiritual heritage. Yitzchak has a Yaakov and an Esav, and they see Esav got excluded from the spiritual heritage. They now see Yosef as driving a wedge by his stories between themselves and their father, and they were afraid that this would repeat the concept of separation, and they felt that this would have destroyed their destiny as a nation of God, and therefore they invoked the halakha of Rodef. Rodef, again, halakha that was quite controversial after the Rabin assassination, but they felt that their spiritual futures were on the line, and they felt Yosef was Chayev Misa, deserved to die. Reuven's argument, says the Or HaChaim, is the following. We should not be the ones who execute sentence, however, because our judgment might be tainted by bias and selfish self-interest. And because of Bechira, the fact that we kill him doesn't mean he deserved to die, because human beings because of their free will, can kill someone even if it was not God's will. But let's throw him to the poisonous snakes. The Erechaim says the following. The Erechaim says an animal has no free will, and an animal is empowered to injure only if it was God's will that the person be injured. And they actually took the position. I wouldn't recommend this idea of going into a snake pit, but they took the position that if Yosef deserves to die, the snake will kill him, and if Yosef does not deserve to die, the snake will not. And that judgment could not be made in terms of human interventions because of the concept of Bechira. And the truth of the matter is, you know, there are these snake charming cults which take the same position, and every year one or two people do die from the handling of snakes. But the truth of the matter is, the Erechaim's idea that human autonomy can override divine will is actually almost an explicit pasuk at the end of the book of Samuel. If you remember, at the end of the book of Samuel, it is recorded that David had committed certain aveirot in counting the Jewish people, etc. And God gave him a choice for the punishment. God said, the nation is going to be punished. I give you a choice. Be attacked in war, suffer a famine, or suffer a plague. And David said, this is a famous verse we say in the Tachanun prayer, Vayomer David El Gad. David says to the prophet God, God was a prophet, Sar li miot, I am greatly distressed. Nipla na biyad Hashem, let me fall in the hands of God by a famine. Ki rabim rachamav, because his mercy is abundant. Uviyad adam al epola, and let me not fall in the hands of man. Now, the truth of the matter is, if the damage that a human can inflict on me is only the measure that has been divinely determined, then what is the difference if God's emissary is a human being or a natural disaster? You actually see that because of the capacity of free will, havoc can be wrecked, which is greater than the parameters of the divine decree. Now, the thing is, this doesn't mean, of course, one cannot pray for intervention and the like, but there is a certain principle of free will. And in a sense, therefore, at least human-inflicted evil is a necessary evil to the establishment of virtuous choice through Bechira. Because imagine this. Imagine a world where evil never prospered. Imagine a world, in other words, let's always ask ourselves the other type of world we could have. Let's imagine a world where every time you did something good, you got $1 million. And every time you did something bad, you got an electric shock. So 5 volts for minor offenses, etc., and it goes up. Well, then we would be pigeons in a Skinner's box, where the pigeon learns to push the lever that gets the current and not push the lever that gets the shock. But then our goodness would not be virtuous goodness. It would be expedience. In effect, God has to set up the world. If you were God, God has to set up the world in a way that goodness does not always come out ahead, because that is the only guarantor that free will is a reality. Of course, somebody once asked me, well, so why does God have to make, all right, free choice, right? You have to have free choice. So why do we have to have a world where the free choice is between good and evil, like the Holocaust? Why couldn't God make the choices good and better? So free will would mean, you know, you could do good or you could do better. Why do you have to have a world where the choice is the worst, most horrendous thing? But somebody said, you know, so since we're not aware, yeah, but since we're not, the truth is that, you know, we can't answer that question, because since we're not aware of how much worse this world could have been. So it could very well be we are living in a good and better. You know, it's hard to imagine the alternative scenarios, but this is what
a few questions. Firstly, with regard to the story of Yosef and his brothers, on the one hand, we see in history that the source of the problems of Israel were from Yosef. We have Yoram ben Nevat led Klal Yisrael to serve idol.
Uh-huh.
And so you see on the one hand that they had a reason to be suspectful. But the other thing is that you see that after Yosef survived the pit, the brothers didn't now say, well, the divine decree, let him go.
That's a very, very powerful question. If you're assuming, like the Yerachayim, that they knew they were throwing him into stakes, and this would have been a test as to his righteousness, then you're right. And I don't have an answer to that. I mean, the logical idea would have been that he showed his righteousness by a miracle. Now, just as an interruption for a second, this is reminiscent of during the Salem witch trials. One of the ways that a witch could prove her, an accuser could prove her innocence, would be that they would tie a weight to her, they threw her in that water. If she sunk, that shows she was not supernatural.
Well,
if she floated, that would indicate
well,
she
was. Well, that's the same thing
right.
With the woman when they took her,
to the
sota.
No, that's not true, because if she was innocent, she was blessed. But here the test was, if you were innocent, you died because you drowned. So
yeah, but
you couldn't
the
win.
The sota itself was powerful enough that it probably, you know, the chances were that you would die from it, so.
No, but according to tradition, it's the opposite. The woman only died if she was guilty. If she was innocent, she was in fact blessed. But so that's a fair test, I guess. But here you have a test where if you're innocent, you die. You know, if you're guilty, you die. You know, yeah.
The other thing is that you mentioned the Rambam earlier. People have problems with what the Rambam said about in Egypt. God did not decree about which individuals in
right.
Egypt would do, and he didn't decree about which nation.
Right.
But the Rambam has to be understood within his total philosophy, which is also that the Rambam believes that any divine prophecy of something negative does not necessarily have to occur. And that if God, like the story of Nineveh, where God sent Jonah to Nineveh to decree that the city will collapse and
right.
be destroyed, so a negative decree can be overturned.
Mm-hmm.
So this, that God said to Abraham that Egypt will enslave your children,
right.
So that's a negative decree, and that's within the realm of Egypt being able to overturn it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have
Well, okay, I mean, certainly the rule you're referring to is the Rambam's rule, based on the biblical narratives, that negative destructive prophecies can always be terminated by God because of his mercy. But the question becomes, that would not be understood as, let's assume that Navi would have commanded me to do something that's negative. I would not be entitled on my own to say, oh, it's negative, so I'm canceling it. I mean, you would need a counter-prophecy to cancel it, and you don't have the counter-prophecy. Yeah, but I just wanted to share some of these problems with you, because they are the fundamental issues of free will, God's knowledge, God being concurrently in existence at all planes of time. And again, the truth of the matter is, again, beyond my expertise, but the modern ideas of time, and Einstein and the like, the notion of the future not yet being here is really an oversimplification. These are concurrent states of existence that in fact are here, and we can actually understand how God is within, not within, God creates those laws of physics, which allows the simultaneous experiences. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. So next week, I plan to do the Kuzari.
No class.
So next time we'll spend a few weeks with the Kuzari, and I'd like you to look at the first gate, first chapter, and some of the second chapter. I just want to say a few words about the Kuzari for a second. The Kuzari is a difficult book in a lot of ways. Rav Yehuda Halevi was great Torah scholar, great poet, great philosopher. But he also had, he didn't like philosophy very much. He unlike the Rambam, who really loved philosophy, Rav Yehuda Halevi knocks it a lot. And it's a very funny thing. If you read the stories of the Khazars, and if you have the Rabbi Korotkin's translation, you have some historical background about the Khazars, you see that the Khazars were a very rough and gruff people. They were kind of a mountainous warrior class. And they also were not very patient with these long, drawn-out philosophical arguments. And Rav Yehuda Halevi is tremendously based on his history. He uses the history of the Jewish people, as recorded in the Torah, as a primary argument for faith. And the truth of the matter is, Maimonides may have drawn from, I'm not sure if Maimonides saw the Kuzari or not, but in the Mishnah Torah, Maimonides uses some of the historical arguments of the Kuzari as well, besides the philosophical. So he also has some very interesting digressions on the Hebrew language, and a major essay on the international dateline. The Kuzari is one of the major halakhic sources on the location of the dateline, and that was very relevant in World War II when people were in China and Japan. And like, so we'll talk about that in 2 weeks.